This is Bob Sorrentino from Italian Roots and Genealogy, and you can find us on YouTube and Facebook. And I'm here today with Tony Ardizzone, who is the author of several books and a short story writer. He's been writing for many, many years. So welcome, Tony. Thank you for being here.
Hey, thank you. It's an honor to be invited to your show.
Thank you. No, the honor is all mine, believe me. So, you know, I certainly want to talk about the your writing and everything. But before we do that, I think you grew up on the north side of Chicago in an Italian neighborhood. Is that right?
Well, I grew up on the north side of Chicago. We lived in flats on Webster Avenue in what is now the DePaul area. We lived on the corner of Fullerton and Southport, which now I think is a fast food restaurant. It was across the street from the currency exchange. And then my father was able to afford a house in what was called Edgewater. I guess it's now Andersonville, around near Bryn Mawr and Clark. We're Northsiders, loyal Cubs fans, and cursed with the Chicago Cubs. If I can tell you a little bit that my father's side of the family is from Sicily. His parents were born in Menfi, and one of the stories about his father is that one of the reasons his father, Vito Ardizzone, came to the Americas was to avoid conscription into the Italian army. Though when he got here, for some reason, he ended up fighting in World War I regardless, but on the side of the Americans. He was sickly and was forced to spend time in a tuberculosis sanitarium. My father and his mother, two sisters, and his younger brother, who sadly was on the autistic spectrum, they lived in the projects, and they were part of St. Philip at Easy's Parish. So that's where we probably would have lived had the city not essentially rezoned and destroyed that area. So they were part of the near north side Italians. My father didn't speak English until he went to grammar school because his father they were on welfare. The story is that pretty much from the age of eight and on, he was responsible for to bring home money. He sold newspapers in Grant Park. Wow. And then later that led to his lifelong second or third job of selling newspapers. He had five stands around the Union Station on Canal. We had a stand in front of Cafe Bohemia. We had one outside of Florsheim Shoes. And he also on the weekends, back when there was theaters and movies, he would sell the Sunday paper on Saturday nights. He worked since the age of eight, and I'm proud that when I was eight, he needed me. And against my mother's wishes, it was a winter evening. That's when I began. He took me on Saturday night, and I had to stand by one of the newsstands. He said, "Don't do anything. If they rob you, let them." You know, I made a lot of tips. My mother put me in so many clothes, I could hardly move my arms. It was a lifelong activity. And throughout my whole life, I and my brothers helped him with the newsstands. And that was a lot. That basically, the newspapers allowed him, our family, we had five kids, allowed him to then be able to put down money on a mortgage on a house.
Wow, fantastic. Yeah, that's fantastic.
So wow. as far as my Italian American experience, it was solely with my father's family. And my mother My mother didn't speak Italian. My mother, there's some question. Well, we didn't know when we were growing up, but she was born out of wedlock, raised by grandparents. They were pretty stern and pretty mean. They were French speaking Germans. I think the mother was born in Alsace. And it was always something I thought, well, we never felt really comfortable. There were five of us in the family. And I always thought, well, they don't like us because we're Italian, or maybe we're too noisy, or maybe, you know, maybe there's some other reason. I always felt very comfortable at my Nana's, at Nana's house. She lived with the younger of my father's two sisters. And I had a blessed position because he was the oldest son and I was the oldest son of the oldest son. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I could do no wrong. You know, and I soon learned with my more wonderful aunts, his sisters, Eva and Guillermo. We called Guillermo May. Eva and May. Eva was a fantastic cook and baker. She was my godmother. May, not so good, but they'd bring out the cookies, and I knew enough to say, "Oh, what happened? Who went to the bakery?" And then May would say, "Nana, did you hear what little Tony said? He wants to know who went to the bakery." And Nana would say, "Moschino." And then I would say, "Oh," and they'd say, try them. And I knew whose was whose. And I would, of course, praise them to the heavens. "Oh, this is so delicious. Someone made these. You made these." So I knew how to put a smile on their face.
That's a great story. Yeah, you know, I grew up like that too, all my aunts cooking everything. But a couple of things on what you said was my grandfather. Well, before I do that, my favorite, because I used to work for Chase, I used to go to Chicago a lot. I know exactly what you mean by Grand Park and the station, because one of our office buildings was just like two blocks from the station. Mm-hmm. Probably one of my all-time favorite restaurants, which I know is gone now, was Rose Angeles. Mm. It was in a house basically on a regular street. And they converted the downstairs of the house into a restaurant, and it was fabulous. But my mom's parents came because my grandfather had fought in the Libyan War in, I guess, 1911 or something like that. And when World War I was breaking out, she said, "You're not going to fight in another, you're not going to leave again. You have, you know," at that time, I think they had two children. And so they came to America because I think my grandfather's brother was here. But I fully think they plan to go back because they left my uncle there. Yeah. Interesting. And I have a little bit of a newspaper background in that my dad was a photographer for the Daily News in New York City. But I have to ask you, so now your father was born here.
Yeah.
Yes. But he didn't speak English until he went to school.
Right. No.
And so what year was he born?
1921.
So right about the same age as my dad, 23.
Yeah. 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 And I met his friends. I would meet his friends at weddings, and they would talk about I would ask all the questions I could about my father. My father was a very hardworking man. He was a little anxious. And later, some years later, I gave a reading, and I was part of an Italian American Writers Festival at Triton College. And my father and mother came. And my father actually stood up and said that he had to confess that when he was a child, he felt quite ashamed and embarrassed about being poor, about taking the wagon to the armory to pick up the food, the welfare food, the cheese and the white butter with the little dye packets or something. And that he was not comfortable being Italian, but all of his friends were. And I think that they were part of a community. You know, he later, I mean, he never changed his name. He didn't hide anything. But I think he knew that it wasn't necessarily an advantage in a city as, can I say this, a city as Irish as Chicago. You know, I lived when I went to school at the University of Illinois. And when I came, I lived in Chicago for 2 years afterwards. Then I got a place on Taylor Street. So I lived in Taylor Street back when there were still parts of, this was 1971, when there were still parts of the old neighborhood that was being torn down. I think Mike Royko wrote really well about this. The betrayal of the alderman Vito Marzullo, who diligently delivered every vote in the world for the Daily Machine, and then Daily's decision to put Circle, University of Illinois Chicago, to put Circle right in that neighborhood and basically rezone that neighborhood. When I was still living there, there were restaurants that were in houses, and then things would be rezoned and then things would close. And I can remember going to, I lived down the block from Mario's Italian ice stand, which was a wonderful place to live in the summer. You could just walk out. I could walk down the front steps, go down a block and a half, and I would be, you know, join the crowds in front of Mario's and get a lemon ice. What a gift. But I could see the transition. I could see the changing, the change of the neighborhood. It's part of the, I don't know if there was a conspiracy or a decision, but at some point, people will look back and they'll talk about Italians in Chicago, and they'll talk about how the city essentially did not enable or help the neighborhoods to stay in the city, so that many Italians then moved to the suburbs.
Well, and that's, you know, that's not so much different than it was in New York. You know, we grew up in Corona, Queens, and funny you mentioned lemon ice, because I don't know if you ever watched The King of Queens on television, but there's a scene at the end of the opening where he walks away with the lemon ice and he drops it. Well, that was like, that was our lemon ice place, because that was like four blocks from my grandmother's house. And when we had a party, we would get like a 5-gallon lemon ice. Yeah. And the funniest thing about that lemon ice stand was you could only have one flavor at a time. You couldn't ask for, like, you know, strawberry and lemon. You could have lemon or you could have strawberry, but you weren't allowed to mix. It was like the soup Nazi. You know?
So you couldn't ask for two. So you couldn't ask for one of each.
No, you couldn't ask for a scoop of one and a scoop of another in the same.
All right.
It wasn't allowed. But it was great lemon ice, because he made everything with fresh fruit. I mean, it was really like, if you got blueberry, there were real blueberries in there.
Oh, I don't know. It's in this heat. It's a wonder why they haven't commercialized it, and why it's not common all over.
Well, but you know, when they do that, it's not the same anyway.
Exactly.
They start taking shortcuts and they change the ingredients, and it has the name, but it's not going to taste like the original lemon ice. But, you know, I had one girl working for me from Chicago, Khadidra, and we were in New York City one time in Little Italy, which is practically gone by now, but there was a little small little bakery there. And I said, come with me. You have to go in. We have to go in here. She says, why? I said, we're going to go inside. I'll tell you why when we get inside. So we get inside, and I said, this is what I smelled when I was growing up. This is the way it smelled. And she says, you're kidding. I said, no, this is the way it smelled in an Italian bakery when I was growing up. And you know, other people don't know that experience, right?
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's truly the case. And I can remember, now that you talk about it, I can remember all the occasions at Nana's house, the smells in the kitchen, And then I would go down the hallway and I'd go into the front room. And the men would be sitting around the TV, you know, with the rabbit ears, with the aluminum foil on top, watching whatever game was on. Nobody smoked. So there was not much of a smell there. But then I would go down the hall and then go in the kitchen and listen to the women. And they would just be cooking and working. It was truly wonderful.
We'll be right back.
Italian Roots and Genealogy is proudly sponsored by Your Dolce Vita and Dawn Matera, connecting people to their purpose in life and continuing their legacy. For more information, contact Dawn at www.yourdolcevita.com. Yeah, and you know, this, and I just said this the other day, the stuff that will come out of those kitchens and the heat, no air conditioning, and they would be there all day, all day.
Absolutely.
That's all I have to ask you. So growing up like that, I'm sure you had some non-Italian friends that you brought home for dinner or to Nona's house. What was their experience when they saw all that food?
Oh, they were amazed. My mother did her very best to cook the meals that Eva and May would give her. Though they would remind her that she never could get it quite right. I should go back and say that, according to the stories, my father was supposed to marry Carmela. Carmela's family lived in the projects. She was half Sicilian, half Mexican. And they could read and write. So they were the scribes for mm-hmm. people. They would write letters and they would read letters. Both of my grandparents were illiterate. And I often told my mother, I say, you know, if he had married Carmela, I'd be able to speak Italian and maybe some Spanish. When I was in high school, I took Spanish. And I said, and I could be bilingual, trilingual. And she would say, but then you wouldn't be here. And I'd say, no, Ma, I'd still be here. She said, oh, she said, you wouldn't like Carmela. She sends us cards from California. You should see her. Right now, she's as big as a house. And there would be a picture of this lovely tanned woman in a muumuu. And indeed, she was a beautiful woman. But I would joke with my mother about that. There's a story about my mother that they never ceased telling. One that my mother really didn't like. Nana said, told my mother that she should bring her the eggs for the pupiculovi. So my mother then got a dozen eggs. Said, how many do you need? She said, a dozen. So my mother got a dozen eggs and gave it to her. No one told her that they should be hard boiled. So when they made the pupiculovi, they discovered that she hadn't hard boiled the eggs. But the friends' reactions were that they were extremely impressed with the food, and particularly Aunt Eva's. Eva would feed the neighborhood, and she could make a plate of a pasta with simple lentils. Mm. And she said that the kids would just go crazy and enjoy and love the food.
I miss those. Certainly miss those days. That's for sure. Yeah. So I want to talk about your writing. You're prolific. You've written many books, many short stories. And in fact, I think you just had a book released recently, correct?
Yeah. The book is called In Bruno's Shadow. Here's a copy. Publishing company in Canada, Guernica Editions. It publishes a lot of work by both Canadians and North Americans, as well as Italians, people of Italian descent. And Bruno's Shadow is set in Rome during the months prior to the death of John Paul II, and has a sequence of stories, interconnected stories of both Americans and Italians. In Rome at that time, a lot of description of Rome itself, Some of the readers have said that it's a marvelous trip to Rome, and it certainly, I think, if you go, if you get a copy and you read it in an air-conditioned home, it might be a less, a little bit more pleasant than right now. I read that, what is it, Rome is 112 degrees Fahrenheit. In the book, there's a variety of characters. What I tried to do was I went to Rome in search of ideas for a book, and then realized that I could find the ideas if I just simply observed the art. There's a lot in here about Bernini's statues. There's a character, a performing artist, who a street artist who imitates Caravaggio, dresses like Caravaggio, and then performs different scenes from Caravaggio's life. There's a scene where he's in a restaurant, and he rigged it so that the waiter brings him the plate of artichokes. This is the story where Caravaggio asks if the artichokes were cooked with butter or oil, and the waiter says, "You taste them." And then Caravaggio threw the dish of artichokes at the waiter, and then there was a tumble and a fight. So what I tried to do was to recreate in a kind of vivid and contemporary way aspects of Rome, and bring Rome alive. And that's in Bruno's shadow. Bruno refers to the statue of Giordano Bruno that's in the Campo di Fiori. He was, I think, a Benedictine. He was he left the order. He was imprisoned. He had some beliefs that were heretical. One of them was that the earth wasn't the center of the universe. And, you know, I think Galileo had some of those similar ideas, but Galileo recanted and wasn't killed. Bruno didn't. Bruno was brutally killed, hung upside down, and burned to death. But Bruno believed that an infinite God, an infinite loving God, created us. And given the idea that Earth was not the center, that there were an infinite universe and an infinite number of suns, wouldn't it make sense that there were an infinite number of planets around those suns? And wouldn't it make sense that there were other God-created beings? This is heresy. Yes, God-created beings.
It's heresy now to some people.
Exactly. Though there's channels on TV that keep saying it's true. So the cover. The cover is that famous picture this is the Flammarion engraving that had nothing to do with Bruno himself, but was used when the PBS stations began to do science articles about the Bruno and the astrology. This shows a man poking his head basically through the atmosphere, looking at the machinations of the heavens. So I tried to bring that aspect into the novel as well.
Have you been back to Italy, you know, many times? I mean, how many times?
I was able to go to Rome at least five times.
Oh, nice.
And I was there in 2004. The book essentially begins on the morning, December 26, 2004, the morning of the South Asian tsunami. And the Pope died the following April. So I thought that was a perfect time to set the book. Mm-hmm. And I took lots of notes, and I went back. Some of my early books were about Chicago, and there's also a North Sider in the book and a South Sider in the book. There's a little bit of Chicago in everything I write.
Well, that makes sense. That's kind of your thing, I guess, right? Yeah.
Well, you write what you know.
Yes. Yes. Okay?
You write what you know. So, one of the characters, she lives on the South Side, and her father owns a bar, and they live upstairs. So I was able to write about a typical Chicago bar. At the time, on the walls are pictures of the saints, John F. Kennedy and Mayor Richard J. Daley. The TV's in the corner, and they're watching, you know, they're watching the Cubs game or the White Sox game or the Bears or the Bulls. You know, the men are at the bar, you know, and the daughters, one of the daughters' jobs is to empty the ashtrays and to work in the bar. So when you've got access to information like that, details like that, of course, you know, it's an invitation to use them in work. I very much like Chicago, and now it's become a kind of habit. There's some Chicago, even though I live in Oregon, Portland, Oregon. I go back periodically, I'm amazed at the changes, but I'm also very happy to see that some things just simply haven't changed.
Yeah, I have. I used to go to Chicago like 6 times a year for like a week.
Yeah.
So, you know, for several years. So I got to know pretty well. And it was a great walking town, great restaurant town. You know, easy to get around and find your way around. I used to stay like on State Street and then walk over to, we were by the river. Mm-hmm. You know, by Union Station. So it was a, you know, maybe a mile walk, but it was always a nice walk. So I'm intrigued because I read a great book just recently and interviewed Carlo Trevisi, who mm-hmm. wrote about Sicily in, you know, 1250.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether somebody wants to write for themselves or, you know, write their personal experiences, their family experiences, or wants to write a fiction book. I'm in awe of people who write fiction because building characters and all of that. So what kind of advice do you have for people who want to maybe just, you know, write their family history?
I would say start. And I think that most people who have success with a project schedule time and don't just start it and then abandon it. I like to work on a schedule. 5 days a week for a couple of hours. And don't worry about making it perfect. When I taught creative writing, I had a position at Indiana University. And when I talked to my writers, I would tell them a story. And I would say, there was one summer when I got a job as a janitor. And let me tell you how we started. We went into a corner of the room and we had tiles and we counted out 9 tiles in the corner. And then we swept them and then we washed them and then we waxed them. Oh, we let it dry. Then we waxed them and then we buffed them. Then we moved on to the next 9, and they would like look at me, and I would say, of course I'm lying, but I'm talking about the way that you often try to write. You try to make it perfect from the beginning. No, what we would do is we'd clear the furniture. Then we'd sweep the room. And this is true. Then we'd wash the floor. And while it dried, we did the next one. Then we wax it, and while it then, and I often was the guy with the buffing machine. So, you know, you don't do everything at once. I think a lot of people, they try to be too perfect, and then, you know, they don't get it right. How do you learn how to play the piano? What if they said, hit only the right notes? I wouldn't do anything. But people do that with writing. They freeze. So the best advice I would give is do it on a regular basis if you're serious about it. And don't beat yourself up. 3 days a week, 2 days a week, 5 days a week, whatever fits into your schedule, sometimes at night. And don't be perfect. Make mistakes. Just get the black on the white. Get the ink on the page. And, you know, and then after a while, you'll get a little momentum, and then after a while, you'll get into the idea, and during the day, you'll have ideas of what to put down. Then jot it on a note, stick it in your pocket the next day, you know. Then, you know, you get a little bit more.
Yeah, when I wrote the first book about, you know, my research and my family the ancestors going back, you know, like, a, you know, 1,000 years or something like that, I changed direction like 5 times on that one.
Yeah.
Because I kept, and maybe that's what you're saying, because I kept trying to get it right.
Yeah.
and I couldn't, you know, so I kept changing it. And then eventually I found out where I wanted to be with it and go from there. The second one that just came out was about my life in banking and my experiences there. And, that was easier because I didn't have to research. It was all on my head, you know, and I didn't have to do all kinds of footnotes and things like that. And I'd really, really like to try a fiction book, but I don't know how to build a character. And I think that may be not just me, but other people too. You know, if you want to write a fiction, or I'd like to do a historical fiction about my family. But I'm stuck on how do I start to build a character? How do you build a character?
Well, one, I would say, first off, there's no right way and wrong way. Whatever works, works. Okay? And so your reference with that first book, I think that probably was exactly what you were supposed to do. Mm. Just don't try to make it perfect. You can't frosting the cake until it's cooked. So you don't, you know, we don't worry about that. And building a character, there's drafts, draft by drafts. You might give a sketch. You can just write down, he's a kind character, but he doesn't like dogs. And then later you could write, you know, you could ask some stuff, and then you'll refine it, but just get some details down. I would say that's incremental. It's bit by bit. What you might do, and what I would have, what teachers had me do, is they would assign a short story for me to write, to copy someone else's short story, word for word. And I can remember being told I needed to write out a short story by James Joyce, the famous Irish writer. One of his stories was called Counterparts. And I had to hand write it. Hmm. And I thought, what is this? This is like what the nuns did in grammar school when I was bad. You know, I must not throw spitballs in class. And I would have, you know, right? But by writing it, it taught me the language. I would say that it would probably be similar if you were teaching a young musician, say a trumpet player, to learn and imitate exactly, and then you give them, say, something by Louis Armstrong, and then they have to try to play it. To learn to go through that motion. So that's something that you can do. There's a bunch of books that are out. One of the ones that I very much like is Bird by Bird, by Anne Lamott. She tells the story that her brother was the type who would procrastinate, and he had to do a research project on birds. And the night before the project was done, he was sitting at the table, stacks of books about birds. And he said, "How am I ever going to do this?" And his father came by and put a hand on the boy's shoulder and said, "Bird by bird, son, bird by bird." And I mean, and that's writing. That's it. Just get it down. And if it doesn't, and if you're stuck, then go somewhere else. You know, it's only a, you know, right. I talk to my students. I try to use a lot of metaphors. You know, how do you clean the house? You're gonna get nowhere if you start to dust and then say, "Oh my God, I have to vacuum. Oh my God, look at those dishes. Wait a minute, I have to take out the garbage." No, just do one thing at a time. You know, if you want to dust, then dust a little bit. The important thing is to put in your time and not beat yourself up and try to enjoy it.
Yeah, and that's fine. That's kind of the conclusion I came to.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were times, you know, to your point, I tried to stay on a certain schedule. I found, like, for me, it was, I don't know why, it was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon for a couple hours, you know. But, you know, to your, and then there were times where I had to stop for a while. I had to walk away for a month, you know, and come back and look at it again. And I, you know, the hardest part of the whole thing was editing it. And I was published by Janaway, and a great person there, Sandra Skid Morris, you know, she said, "You're never going to catch every typo." She
said,
"Do the best you can." She says, "I'll do the best I can, but believe me, you're never going to catch them all. There's always going to be something in there." Because that was making me nuts. Every time I went back, I would see another typo. I'm like, oh my God. And, you know, well, and one of the things I did was I got, which helped a lot, I got, it was an app called Ghostreader. So I could put it in there and it would read it back to me. And I was amazed at how many things, because when you look at the page, you're seeing what you think you're supposed to see. But when you hear it, you hear the mistake.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a wonderful thing. And I think that there's no rules. And I would say that you did exactly what you needed to do. I'm reading a book by another Chicago writer, Christina Morocco. She teaches at Elgin Community College. The book is called Adio Love Monster. And in the introduction, she mentions that her husband read to her every chapter. What a gift. And it's a beautiful book. It's about an Italian family in a set in the 1950s. In a suburb, she calls it Mulberry, but a fictional suburb of Chicago. And a street with a family, an extended family that lives there among other people, several non-Italians. And I thought, what a wonderful way to be able to revise your work, to have someone else read it and read it out loud to you, because then you can hear it and do exactly what you've done.
Yeah. Like I said, it made a big difference. So before we go, give us the name of the book again, and where people can go buy it. And I know you also have a website too, right?
Yeah. The book is called In Bruno's Shadow. And it's available certainly. Oh, I would say, support your local bookstore. And there are ways that you can avoid. But of course, there's Amazon.com. The website, if you don't have the address, I know that when you list them, you have the address. The address is simply www.tonyartizzoni.com. I always know who's a friend. When back in the days when we would receive phone calls, I always knew that it was a sales pitch when people would stumble over the last name or mispronounce it. But I hope it's a book. I hope it's a book that people would like. And I don't want to confuse people too much, but another book is called In the Garden of Papa Santuzzo. And this was a book that I wrote about. I invented a family that lives in Girgenti. And one by one, the father and his wife, Adriana, send their children to the Americas. So it's a book about the movement of Italians, or specifically Sicilians, to the Americas. But this is the book right now that was recently released, and one that I hope that people will read, and I hope that people will enjoy.
I'm sure they will. Well, listen, Tony, thanks again. I really appreciate you taking the time.
It's been totally my pleasure. Thank you so much for giving me that time.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Sorrentino, just letting you know that my new book, Farmers and Nobles, is now available for sale on www.italiangenealogy.blog/farmersandnobles, or you can find the link in the podcast notes. Thanks for listening.